Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is May the 27th. We are in Parshas Bahar. We are on page... Let's see. Is it 702?
That's where my marker was. And yours. No, you're 702.
Yeah, 702 is right.
35.
Yeah. Now, we had left off last time reading the previous paragraph, and we talked about the Levium at the end of the previous paragraph, which was about selling houses. And the last pasuk, the last verse of pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 34 of that paragraph, says, "Usade migrash arehem lo yimocher," and the field of their that's been allotted to them for their cities shall not be sold. Ki achuzas olam hi lahem hu lahem, because it is an inheritance, or it's an internal heritage for them. They can't be sold. Now, we mentioned last time that this really is not what it seems at face value. It can be sold. And it's referring to something very specific, which if we would wait until we got there, it would take a long time. It's actually discussing something which we're not going to get to until the end of Parshas Bechukosai, which is the next parsha, not the very end of the next parsha. So I'm going to bring it up now, knowing that when we get to it at the end of Bechukosai, we're going to have to review it, because that's actually where it's discussed. And this has to do with a person making their field hektish. A person can donate anything to the Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, if you donate an animal that is without a blemish and that can be brought in the Mizbeach, then that animal can be offered as a karbon. You can also donate flour that can be offered on the Mizbeach. You can donate ketores, incense. You can donate wood that can be burned on the Mizbeach, wine. But you can also donate items that would not be used on the Mizbeach, but they go into the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash, the Berek HaBayis, and the Beis HaMikdash uses it. They use the items for money or to produce other things, whatever is necessary. Therefore, people can donate fields to the Beis HaMikdash. People can donate cars. People can donate whatever they want to the Beis HaMikdash. You can make things hektish. Today, obviously, we don't do that. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash to give it to. But if someone would say that this item should be hektish from the word kedusha, sanctity, means that one is donating this item to the Beis HaMikdash, simply saying that this item is hektish transfers ownership from him to the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara has a rule, amiraso legavoa kemisiraso lehedyot dami. Amiraso legavoa, by stating that he's giving it to gavoa, gavoa means above, to the Beis HaMikdash, that is akin to misiraso lehedyot, giving it over to a regular person. If I state that I would like to give this as a gift to you, it doesn't become yours just because I said that. It only allows you to then acquire it. Then if I then hand it to you and you pick it up, now it becomes yours. But you have to make a kinyan. You have to do something to acquire it. Simply my saying that I'm going to gift it to you or that I'm gifting it to you does not actually transfer ownership. That only allows for the transfer of ownership. But when you say that I am gifting this to the Beis HaMikdash, then immediately the ownership is transferred. It becomes the property of the Beis HaMikdash. Simply the words that I am gifting it to the Beis HaMikdash transfers the ownership. So one can do that with their field. One can say that I am donating my field to the Beis HaMikdash. If one would do that, then immediately the field becomes the property of the Beis HaMikdash, which means it comes under the control of the gizbar, of the treasurer of the Beis HaMikdash. Whoever is the treasurer at that time now has control of that field. Obviously not for their personal gain, for the use for the Beis HaMikdash, but it now becomes the property of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash can use that property to produce items that are needed for the Beis HaMikdash, or the Beis HaMikdash can produce revenue. How would the Beis HaMikdash produce revenue? They can sell the field to somebody else and produce revenue in that way. Now, anything that is donated to the Beis HaMikdash, unless it is an actual carbon, if it is just something that goes into the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash, it can also be nifter. It can be redeemed. So that if I would say that this should become the property of the Beis HaMikdash, so any one of you could then come, pay for it, it becomes yours, and the money now becomes the property of the Beis HaMikdash. Because after all, what's the Beis HaMikdash going to do with the water bottle? So the money becomes the revenue of the Beis HaMikdash. It becomes their money. If the owner, the one who originally gifted it to the Beis HaMikdash, wants to buy it back, the general rule is the owner can buy it back, but has to add a fifth, which is really 25%. It's really a quarter. After you add a quarter to the principal, it becomes that number becomes a fifth. 25 is a quarter of 100. When you add 25 to 100, now you have 125. 25 is a fifth of 125. So it's 20% after you add it on. So it's what we would probably call 25%. So that's typically what happens, that if the original owner wants to redeem it, wants to buy it back, then they have to pay the principal plus 25%. That's typically the rule.
But if someone else already came and bought it and gave him money, does that mean that the original owner can get it from this other person?
No, it belongs to the other person now.
Okay.
The other person could sell it to me if they wish, but that's a private transaction.
And then the yoga
here? Oh, wait, I'm talking about with fields, we're going to talk about in a minute. That's so far I'm talking about a water bottle. Okay, fields is where it changes. Now, if, let's not discuss Levium, let's discuss a regular Yisrael has land in Eretz Yisrael. This is what we're going to learn about at the end of the Fukosai. And they gift their land, their own ancestral land, not land that they bought from somebody else, but land that is theirs within the family, and they gift it to the Beis HaMikdash. So, remember, we've learned until now that your ancestral land, you can't lose. It's always going to come back to you. In the Yovel year, it'll come back to you. And therefore, really, it's a long-term lease. A sale is not really a sale. It's really a long-term lease. We talked about the disincentive for anybody but you to develop the land because it's going to come back to you anyway. The exception to this is when you make your land hektish. When you gift your land to the Beis HaMikdash, you are at risk for losing your land permanently. And the way it works is as follows. If I would gift my ancestral land to the Beis HaMikdash, or part of my ancestral land to the Beis HaMikdash, so right now, it becomes the property of the Beis HaMikdash, and the Beis HaMikdash can either work the land or sell the land, do whatever they want with the land. If I choose to buy it back, then I can do that, and the Beis HaMikdash will end up with the revenue. Either way, it's a gain for the Beis HaMikdash. They didn't pay for the land, so either they have land or they have money. Either way, it's fine. That's good for the Beis HaMikdash. However, if I don't quickly purchase it back, how long, it doesn't say in the Torah how long you have, just says that if the original owner does not take steps to buy it back, the gizbar, the treasurer of Hektish, has the right to sell the land to a third party, someone else who would like to purchase the land. And that's acceptable for the treasurer to do that, which would generate revenue for the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the purchaser is not going to be able to keep the land at Yovel. As we all know, when you buy land in Israel, you have to return it at Yovel. The question is, to whom does he return it? Where, and if I would sell land, my land to a third party, or actually a second party in this case, if I would sell land to somebody, so in Yovel it gets returned to me. But in this case, I didn't sell it. It was Hektish that sold it. The treasurer of Hektish sold the land to a third party. In Yovel, the third party must return the land. But to whom? And the answer is, to Hektish. And what happens to the land? The land then becomes the property of the Kohanim. And it is forever lost to my family. The way that I can lose my ancestral land permanently, or portions of my ancestral land, the Torah warns against giving all your land to Hektish. Shouldn't do that. But the way that I could lose portions of my land permanently is if I gift it to the Beis HaMikdash and then do not purchase it back before somebody else buys it from Hekdesh. Once a third party buys it from Hekdesh, now I can't get it back. Even if I then go to that third party and buy the land from the third party, which is a way for me to get my own land back, but at Yovel it's going to go to the Beis HaMikdash, and the Beis HaMikdash will then give it to the Kohanim. That's what's going to happen. There is a difference of opinion whether that's an automatic transfer from the Beis HaMikdash to the Kohanim, or whether the Kohanim have to pay for it. That's a whole discussion in and of itself. But it does not come back to me. It goes to the Kohanim. Which Kohen gets it? Whichever shift of Kohanim are working in the Beis HaMikdash at the onset of the Yovel year. At the moment when the fields return to the owner, that whichever shift of Kohanim happens to be the shift that's running at that time, they will get whichever lands were sold to Hekdesh, gifted to Hekdesh and sold to a third party, they will get all those lands. So there is a windfall to the Kohanim who are working at the moment when Yovel starts every 50 years. It works out that it's not if over a long period of time every mishmar, every shift of Kohanim will have a chance. It just, you have to work out the math of how the years work, but it'll work out that way. But that's a discussion which we'll have when we get to the end of Bechukosai. But and that is with a typical gifting of land to Hekdesh. You have a question?
Yeah, I had a financial question. So when the person who donated the land to the Beis HaMikdash and so for Hekdesh, and he did, if he wants to get it back, you said he has to pay 5%.
Yeah, 25%.
Is that considered to be a donation to the Beis HaMikdash, that
25%? Or
is that the value? And how is the Yovel getting into the? Is being calculated into the price of that first transaction?
Okay, the price of the transaction is the same as the way we calculate it normally, which is that you take the years until Yovel and figure it out, and you prorate it. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. But then you have to add that 25% penalty.
And that 25% is considered like a donation?
Yeah, I mean, what else? I mean, it goes to the Beis HaMikdash.
Right.
Yeah, it's the purchase price for the original owner.
It's not interest?
No, it's not interest. No. The Torah, we'll learn about it again at the end of Bechukosai, that typically when you buy back your own item, you have to add 25%.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in case if it's been sold to a third party.
Yeah.
So again, it's proportional to the Yovel.
Yes.
Right. And then it will never go. The
original owner will not get it back.
Right.
And there is an incentive to Hekdesh to sell it back to the original owner because it gets the extra 25%.
Yeah. If there's no third party and the Yovel year comes, then does it go back to the original?
No, too late.
So then it always stays with the
Yes. Kohanim. The only way it would not stay with the Kohanim...
That's a very special thing. I can see where it would.
Yeah. So the only way it would not stay with the Kohanim is if the original owner buys it back first and before Yovel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, we're going to talk about all this at the end of the Bechukosai. Right. But the reason we bring it up now is because the Torah here is saying that all these rules do not apply to the land of Levium. Since Levium only have 48 cities, and they have a little bit of land around the cities, far less land than anybody else, than regular Yisraelim. They don't have all the large tracts of land that the rest of the Jews have. So the Torah wants to ensure that the Levium cannot lose their land even through making the land Hekdesh. And if a Levi makes his land Hekdesh, and then the land is redeemed by a third party, then in Yovel it will go back to the Levi. It will not remain with the Kohanim. And that's what it means here in Lamed Daled in 34 when it says, Usade migrash arehem lo yimacher, and how they translate it here, the fields of the open land of their cities may not be sold. It doesn't mean they may not be sold. They can sell their land like anybody else could sell their land. However, it means it cannot be sold permanently, which means if a Levi makes his land Hekdesh, he donates it to the Beis HaMikdash, and then the Gizbar, the treasurer, sells it to a third party, it will not be a permanent sale. That's what it means here. Lo yimacher means it cannot be sold permanently by the gizbar, by the treasurer, to a third party, which means it will not go back to the Kohanim in Yovel, but rather it will go back to the original Levi, or the original Levi who sold it, ki achuzas olam hu lahem, for it is an inheritance forever. That's what's being said over here. Bear in mind, when we say the term Levi, we also mean Kohanim. Levi just means the tribe of Levi, which includes the Kohanim. The 48 cities of Levium were also where the Kohanim lived. There were far more Levium than Kohanim, Kohanim being only one family within the tribe of Levi. However, the cities, the 48 cities, had Levium and had Kohanim. Therefore, a Kohen could theoretically donate his land to the Beis HaMikdash. That's in theory what could happen. But again, when the Yovel comes, even if the land would be sold to a third party, it will go back to this Kohen, not to the Kohanim who happened to be working in the Beis HaMikdash at that time. Rather, it will go back to this original Kohen who owned the land to begin with. And that is to ensure that the Kohanim and the Levium do not lose their small ancestral plots in Israel. They remain with the Kohanim and the Levium. And that's what is meant over here. It's a pasuk that one would read it at face value, one would not understand what it means, because it sounds like it can't be sold, but it doesn't mean it can't be sold, it means it can't be sold permanently. So whereas a non-Kohen or Levi could actually give up their land permanently, that cannot happen to a Kohen or to a Levi. Okay. Pasuk Lamed Hei, verse 35. V'chiyamucha chicha umata yado imach. When your brother shall become impoverished and his hand will falter with you, thank you. V'achazakta bo, you shall hold him or strengthen him. Ger v'soshav, a ger, a convert, v'soshav, that would be a non-Jew who has accepted the seven mitzvos. V'chai imach, and he shall live with you. He shall live with you. So the Torah here is telling us to prevent a person from becoming very impoverished. The Rashi says v'chazakta bo means that you shall strengthen him before he falls precipitously. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read you the Rashi. Al tanicheu sheyered v'yipol. Do not allow him to go down and fall. V'yekasha lahakimo. It'll be difficult to lift him up. Elachazkeu mishas motas hayad. You should strengthen him from the moment the hand falters. Meaning as soon as you see that this person is having some sort of financial difficulty, immediately step in and help the person. Lema zedoma. What is this similar to? Lemasui shalachamar. A burden that is on a donkey. A donkey can carry a very heavy load. Odeu ala chamor, as long as it's still on the donkey, even though it's starting to fall, echad tofes bo umamido, one person can grab it and keep it on the back of the donkey. Even though it's extremely heavy, but as it's starting to tip, one person can get over there and hold it up there and it won't fall off. However, nafal la'aretz, once it falls to the ground, chamisha ein ma'amidino, so even five men will no longer be able to lift it. It may be too heavy for even five men to lift it. As long as the load is still up there, one person can hold it up. Once it falls to the ground, it may be too heavy for even five men. So this mashal, this parable, is being used for a person, a human being, or a family that seems to be faltering financially. We are commanded to step in quickly prior to their falling precipitously. As long as the financial troubles are just beginning, then they can be arrested before they become very bad. But once there really is financial stress, it could be that it's so bad that it would take an enormous amount of intervention and tzedakah to help that family. So it's important to try to nip it in the bud. A person, God forbid, loses their job. So generally speaking, a person loses their job, they're obviously in trouble, because where's the next paycheck going to come from? But usually, most people, there is a little bit of a period of time where they can kind of get by, where they kind of scrap by before things get really bad. Catch it then. Don't wait for the person to be in dire straits where they have nothing and there's nothing at all in the cupboard. And now it's going to take an enormous amount to get the person back on their feet. That's what's being said over here. This applies to to Jews. It also applies to converts, to a ger. It also applies to a toshav. A toshav is, as I said, a non-Jew that has accepted upon themselves the seven mitzvos of Bnei Noach. They have formally accepted it. When a ger toshav accepts those seven mitzvos, then they are allowed to live in Israel amongst us. We're not supposed to allow non-Jews who have not accepted the seven mitzvos to live among us, because they will influence us in a bad way. However, once they've accepted the seven mitzvos, then they live among us, and they are given many of the privileges that a Jew has. This is one of them.
I assume people do that today. They want to... Do they go before a rabbi and say, I accept this?
Today, I'm not sure that there is a formal acceptance of it. There are people who consider themselves Noahides, and they try to keep the seven mitzvos. It was well known that when my Rosh Hashiva of Weinberg, Zechon Mavracha, was alive, that there were a group of Noahides who would be in regular consultation with him to ask their questions. But I don't believe that there is a formal process today. Since we're not in Israel, we don't have it. Well, we have Israel. We don't have Israel in a total way. I don't think that there is a formal process today.
Thank you.
Pasuk Lamed Vav, verse 36, here is one of famous mitzvahs of the Torah. Al tikach me'ito neshech v'sarbis. Do not take from him interest. You shall fear your God. Your brother shall live with you. That a person is not allowed. A Jew is not allowed to charge another Jew interest. This prohibition is mentioned a few times in the Torah. In this case, it is referring to the lender, not to take interest from the borrower. We've said before that the prohibition is also on the borrower to pay the interest. That's also a prohibition. It goes both ways. The lender may not charge the interest. The borrower may not pay the interest. It is an aveira on both of them if they are involved in a transaction that involves interest between two Jews. As you probably know, there is an instrument that one can use to avoid interest. That is a heter iska. It is a document. It needs to be done in a particular way. If one needs to be involved in an interest-bearing transaction with another Jew, one should definitely use a heter iska. If one does not know how it works, one should speak to their LOR and get guidance for how to use a heter iska. But without the heter iska, it is prohibited for a Jew to charge interest to another Jew, and it is prohibited for a Jew to pay interest to another Jew.
The way it's written, it suggests that the same thing would apply to not charging interest to the Noahide.
That's what it appears as well. It seems that way as well. From the way that the Torah writes it over here, that would seem to be true.
So it's not just another Jew,
right? That's what it appears. Okay. That's what it appears.
It appears, but it is.
It means I'm not sure.
Oh.
But that is certainly what it appears to be saying.
Lots of Jews throughout our history. I mean, I don't know the time of the temple, but have been able to survive by knowing.
With non-Jews.
That was the only profession they could have.
Yeah, but it's perfectly permissible to charge interest or pay interest to a non-Jew. That's perfectly acceptable. That's perfectly acceptable. One needs to be careful of this when being involved with transactions. Interest, there is the Torah prohibition of interest. The simple type of interest is that I lend you $10 on condition you pay me back $11. That's straight out clear interest. But there are various types of interest-bearing transactions which are not clearly interest, but they would still nevertheless fall under the prohibition, either the Torah prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition involving interest. So, for example, when my children had their orthodontia, we used an orthodontist, a very capable orthodontist, who is Jewish. He just retired, but he is Jewish, but is not observant. And the contract, the standard contract that he issues his clients, says that the payment will be spread out over however much time and a certain amount of money per month. And in the event that you are late with your payment, there'll be a penalty added to the payment, which is a standard thing to do. So when our first child had orthodontia with this orthodontist, so we were sitting at his desk and he showed me the contract. I read it over and then I said to him, this line here is a problem because we're both Jewish and we're not allowed to charge each other or pay each other interest. So it's an issue. So he said, Rabbi, whatever you want. You want to cross it out? Go right ahead. And that has been our arrangement with all the children that have had orthodontia with this doctor. We have crossed out that line and signed the contract. But so one has to be careful with these things that they can come up, that there is an interest, that you're signing something that involves interest, and the truth is, it is an issue. Whether it really would be an issue or in that case is not so straightforward, meaning, let's say I would have signed it without crossing out the line, but my payments would have always been on time, and I never would have actually been charged nor paid the interest. Mm-hmm. Then it could be that it would have been fine, that it would not have been a problem, but we would have been at risk for the potential problem. That would have been the issue in that case.
Great teaching tool that you did.
Okay. Well, we had a conversation about it. So
to me, the word penalty sounds different than
right. So that's why it may only be rabbinic. It may not be a Torah prohibition in that case because it's worded as a penalty. It's not worded as a definite thing that there's that this is an interest bearing loan. But the way that we may look at it is that that every day that I'm late with the payment, it's as if he's lending me money. Because really I'm supposed to have paid him, and now I'm not paying him, so he's allowing me not to pay him, which means I'm holding on to his money, but it's for extra payment, which would be interest. So that would be the thing. But you're right, it may only be rabbinic and not Torah in nature. Right. It says, V'chei achicha imach, your brother shall live with you. This is one of the places in the Torah where we understand that your life takes preference over the life of anybody else, which means that as we know, the chayecha kodmin, that you're not allowed to give up your life for somebody else's life. Your life comes first before somebody else's life. The Torah requires each of us to protect our own lives. Now, that doesn't mean that we can proactively do that, which means, as we've talked about before, if a non-Jew puts a gun to a Jew's head and says, kill that Jew or I will kill you, the Jew has to allow themselves to be killed. You're not allowed to kill someone to save your life either. But here we're talking about that there is a bullet that is aimed for another person, then one should not jump in front of that bullet. Your own life takes preference over someone else's life, or more, perhaps, I don't know if it's more dramatic or maybe easier to wrap your mind around, is the classic case of the Gemara, where two people are in a desert and they are a day's journey from water. One of them has enough water to make it to the source of water. The other one has none. So the one who does not have water is going to die because they can't they don't have anything to sustain themselves. The one with the water, of course, is in a moral dilemma because I'm going to survive, but what about my friend here? They don't have anything to drink, but I'm responsible for my own life first. And therefore, I'm not allowed to give up the water to that person. I have to take care of my own life first. Your life precedes the life of your friend. Yeah.
What about the issue of Yahaz Lerecha Kamacha? Because there have been instances of Chayalim in Israel. There was one a few years ago in the yeshiva. The terrorists came into yeshiva and when the bachur closed the door.
Yeah, that's a famous story with that bachur. There are several answers to that question. First of all, that bachur was probably going to get killed as well. So he wasn't giving up his life to save others, meaning it wasn't that he would have survived and they would have been killed. He wasn't exchanging himself for anybody else. He closed those doors so that he would be the only one killed. So that was an incredible act of heroism that he did, thinking about others first rather than worrying more about himself. But in that case, he wasn't exchanging his life for somebody else, most likely.
And what about himself?
Second of all, there can be situations where it's a question of a large amount of people and one decides that they will give themselves up to save a bunch of other people. But it is unclear. It's not so simple to do that if one's own life is not also in danger. That's where it's not so clear to do. There's a drowning person, so to jump in and get drowned to save that person, that's not such a simple thing to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
That interest question.
Yes.
What about corporations?
Yes.
It's sort of like
yeah.
big lump.
So corporations is it's a modern concept. Mm-hmm. It's a made-up idea. It's something which was created here in the United States, actually. And the concept of a corporation is that there is an entity that is able to own things and conduct transactions, and that entity is not a single human being. It's not even a partnership of human beings. It is some sort of
moral entity.
Right. What's it called?
The legalese is moral.
Moral entity, some sort of ephemeral type of entity, right? And it protects the individuals who are members of that corporation. That's how we are aware of it. So Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses being involved in an interest-bearing transaction with a Jewish-owned corporation. The rationale may be permitted because the corporation is not really a Jew. It may be owned by Jews, but it is not really a Jew. It is this ghost-like entity. So he does discuss it. He does have some leniencies because of that. He doesn't say it's a carte blanche that, you know, now you can do whatever you want, but he does have several leniencies based on the corporation. So again, as these questions become more complex, I'm not prepared to answer them. There it would take some research on my part to answer each one, but but certainly if one is going to be involved in this, one should speak to a competent rabbi.
Yeah. Credit card every time.
Right. Okay. So the credit card, if it is owned by a Jew, if it is issued by a Jewish owned bank, so then that bank is lending you money. Every time you use a credit card, you're borrowing money from the bank. But the good thing about a credit card is that there's no interest charge unless you're late.
Right.
So one can avoid the interest payments simply by paying on time. But again, you do have the risk over there of being late and then having to deal with the interest. So if it is a corporation, which most of the time it is a corporation, so again, one should speak to a competent rabbi about the issue. Yeah. Okay. The Torah continues, Lamed Zayin 37, Es kaspecha lo sitin lo b'neshech, do not give your money to him with interest, ufam arbis lo sitin achlecha, and with interest do not give your food. Interest does not only apply to money, it applies to items as well. I can't lend my neighbor a dozen eggs, and my neighbor will give me back 14 eggs. Can't do that. It applies to food as well. It doesn't only apply to money. This does become an issue sometimes, not on purpose, but sometimes what happens is your neighbor wants to borrow sugar. So you don't have a full bag of sugar. You have a mostly full bag of sugar. You lend it to your neighbor. Neighbor uses the whole whatever you have. Then your neighbor buys a full bag of sugar and returns it to you because, you know, they borrowed a bag of sugar from you. But the truth is you didn't lend them a full bag of sugar. They're giving you back a full bag of sugar. That can be an interest problem. So, but it's done. So what is done about it? So there are those who are very stringent to make sure not to do things like that. And there are those who go so far, in order to avoid this problem, to always pay their neighbor for whatever it is that they take from them, rather than borrow it. That on the spot they'll pay for it. You come to borrow sugar. This is what I have. Okay, we will come up with a price right here and now, and we can agree on whatever price we want. I could sell it to you for 10 cents. I could sell it to you for $10. That's not interest, because in a sale we can agree to a sale price. That's different than interest. Interest is that there's a loan. And then later, more is paid back. But if on the spot we agree that this $10 item, we're going to agree that you'll only pay 50 cents for it, that's acceptable. We can agree to whatever price we want for an immediate sale, an immediate transaction. So there are those who are stringent to do that every time that they borrow from their neighbors, rather than get into an interest question. However, the way around the problem, the reason why you don't have to worry about having done this in the past and that what happens if it comes in the future. The reason is because we say that Shechinim, neighbors, are neighborly. And neighbors who are close, who have a relationship with each other, so they don't pay attention to these things. And since they're not paying attention to it, therefore it is not considered an interest-bearing thing, because it's not that I'm giving you a lesser amount and you're giving me back more. We're not even thinking about it. I'm giving you whatever it is, you're giving me whatever it is. We're not being so
particular,
yakish about it. We're just exchanging things. And sometimes I give you, sometimes you give me, and that's the way it goes. And therefore, we're always mochel, we don't really care, and therefore, it doesn't fall into an interest-bearing loan. It's just giving things to each other right and left. It's really just gifts upon gifts upon gifts upon
all
gifts.
All in the family.
Yeah, that's really what it ends up being. Right. Yeah. So if you have that sort of relationship, then it ends up not being a problem. But it would make a difference if it was someone who you didn't have that relationship with. If it was a neighbor either that you weren't friendly with, mm-hmm. or if it was someone who you really didn't know and you really did expect that person to pay back, where it was a real exchange, you know, that let's say it wasn't something which most of us would give up, you know, a couple of eggs, most people are not going to be so particular about. But what if the neighbor comes and wants to borrow something that actually costs, you know, a good amount of money, some item that's, you know, perhaps a $20, $30, $40 item, and then you are expecting it back. You're expecting to get paid back, either in cash or in items. So if it's in items, it has to be the same. It can't be more, because then it would be an interest-bearing loan. Pasuk Lamaches, verse 38. Ani Hashem Elokeichem asher hotzeisi eschem eretz Mitzrayim. I Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt. L'aseis lachem es eretz Kanan, to give you the land of Canaan, lios lachem le'lokim, to be for you as a god. So the Torah always has to warn that I am Hashem your God about a type of mitzvah either that's very difficult to keep or a mitzvah that you may be tricking others into thinking that you're keeping but you're really not. And Hashem has to say, I know. You may be able to trick people, but you can't trick me. So with interest-bearing loans, the reason why it has to be said is because it is, as we said, it is permitted, 100% permitted, to borrow and pay interest, borrow with interest and pay interest, to a non-Jew and from a non-Jew. That's perfectly acceptable. So a Jew who is lending money on behalf of a non-Jew, that's permitted. If he's the agent of the non-Jew, he's working for the non-Jew. The non-Jew, it's a non-Jewish owned bank, and there's a Jew working for that bank who's the loan officer and involved in your transaction. That's perfectly acceptable. It's not his money. It's the bank's money. It's the non-Jew's money. That's perfectly acceptable. But what can happen is that's a formal situation. That's hard to have a for the following to happen. But if it's not that formal, it could happen that you have a Jewish moneylender who presents himself as lending money that really belongs to a non-Jew, when in fact he's lending his own money. So he's tricking his fellow Jew and saying, this is not my money, I'm working on behalf of the Gentile, and therefore we're allowed to have an interest-bearing transaction over here. But really, it's his own money. And really, he's the one making the profit on the loan. And since one can trick another person that way, therefore the Torah has to say, Hashem says, I know what's going on. The way it could happen is the following. I can go and borrow money from a non-Jew at, let's say, about $100 at 5% interest, and turn around and lend it to you at 10% interest. So what's happening is, it's really my money. It's money that I borrowed from the non-Jew. That means right now it's my money. I owe him, but right now this cash is my cash. So when I lend it to you, I may say that it's his money, because it did come from him originally, but right now it's mine. And I'm the one charging you the 10% interest so that I can make a profit, so that when I pay him back, I'll end up with the extra money. So that is prohibited, and I can make it appear like it's all him and not me. And that's why it has to say that Hashem says, but I know what's going on. Don't play games. I know what's happening. Of course. Again, you're going to get into corporation issues over there, but yes, that is standard business practice, right? And the Torah here also says that I'm doing this to give you the land of Canaan. In the merit of these mitzvos, we get the land of Canaan. By keeping Hashem's mitzvos, that's how we get it. And lios lachem elokim, to be for you for God, this is very important. The Torah says, or Rashi, I'll read the Rashi to you, shekol hador be'eretz Yisrael, anybody who lives in Israel, ani lo le'elokim, I am for him a God. V'chol hayotzei mimena, anybody who leaves Israel, ka'oved avoda zara, is like worshipping idols. How's that? How's that to promote Aliyah?
Wow.
Okay, this is a powerful, powerful statement.
We never mention it, though.
Yes, this is a powerful statement. So the reason we don't mention it is the following. First of all, it's unclear whether this is true even today, where we don't have a functioning Torah government in Israel with a Beis HaMikdash, with a king and all that. It's unclear whether this is still applicable today.
It's still a Jewish government.
It is a Jewish government, but it is not a government that's keeping the Torah.
Right.
So it's not clear
some
that...
Some of them do.
No, but they don't keep it as a law.
It's pretty much
the law doesn't follow the law of the Torah.
Of
right. So it's unclear that this statement would be applicable. But even beyond that, the prohibition is against leaving Israel. The person who's there, and they leave for no good reason, then it is as if they are worshipping idols. A person has a perfectly good life in Israel with a perfectly healthy financial situation, and they say, you know what, I'd rather live in
Atlanta, Georgia.
I'd rather live in India. So they leave Israel to go live in India. So then that's where this prohibition would kick in. That's where this statement would kick in, that it says if they're worshipping idols because they're rejecting Israel. But if a person is unable to live there for many, and there are many reasons why a person could have a problem living in Israel. It could be financial. That's a big reason today is financial. Another reason could be cultural. For whatever reason, it's difficult for a person to be there, then they would not be like they're worshipping idols. But even if we're able to limit this pasuk, still, obviously, it's a very strong statement that it is a wonderful thing to be living in Israel, and when one leaves Israel, it is more difficult to be a God-fearing Jew when one leaves Israel. Israel is the place that is set up for us to be worshiping Hashem properly and for Hashem to be our God. We're leaving Israel, it makes it more difficult. That is what is being stated in this pasuk. Very important thing to bear in mind. Okay, we are going to stop a little bit early this evening.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.